Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
When you are pioneering anything or introducing new ideas to the culture,
you get criticized.
You do?
Yeah. Did you hear about that?
I didn't find the one. I found someone I respected and we made it the one.
In a sort of longing kind of view of love, people understand each other as if by magic.
Nothing in itself is addictive on one hand. On the other hand, everything could be addictive if there's an emptiness in that person that needs to be filled.
I now know that nobody changes until they change their energy. And when you change your energy, you change your life.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Here we go. My guest today is Maya Feller. Maya is a remarkable nutritionist and registered dietitian. Her new cookbook, which I adore, is called Eating from Our Roots, which is out today from Goop Press. This book is such a beautiful representation of Maya's approach to food. She combines amazing nutritional education and science with a culturally inclusive perspective and a palpable love of global ancient ways of eating. Today, I got to sit down and learn more from Maya. We talked about the big systemic questions at the intersection of food, privilege, and access. And Maya shared her baseline recommendations for cooking for chronic conditions, her thoughts on intermittent fasting, and different ways to bring more joy and flavor into the kitchen. Let's get to my chat with Maya Feller. I love this book so much. I can the palpable feeling of love, nurturing, nutrition, science. It's just a 10 out of 10. Congratulations. I'm so excited to have a copy in my hands. It's just gorgeous. How did you choose to be a nutritionist and why?
That's such a good question. And I realized we're diving in and I didn't even ask you how you are, which is very uncharacteristic of me. How are you?
For the most part, I'm good. I've been dealing with sort of chronic inflammation and then I discovered I had mold toxicity and so I've been I'm in process and it's going well, but man, it's a long, slow process, to the point of the job of a nutritionist. Never did I realize the impact that food could have. I mean, mm-hmm. Of course, I always I don't know if you know my story at all, but the reason that I got into wellness is because when my dad, who was the love of my life, got diagnosed with cancer, I was there has to be a reason for this. Mm-hmm. It can't, I mean, I know he was a smoker 30 years ago, but or at least something we can do now to impact this. And he just had no interest in exploring anything alternative whatsoever. So I started researching and anyway, learning a lot about environmental toxins and what we're eating and pesticides and, processed foods and everything in your wheelhouse and tried to get him to be more healthy. He took no part in it. So I started to do it so that maybe by proxy, and I was damn, I feel so much better eating. My first foray was into macrobiotics. So that tells you how fucking old I am. But
you brought back macro. Oh my gosh. But that is a throwback. I'm not going to lie. That's a throwback.
But, so again, just this deepening in the being a student and a recipient of how important food, certain food is. And I feel like this landscape has gotten so sophisticated since the 90s when I was trying to convince my dad to eat brown rice, you know? So anyway, tell me how you, like, what was the bug where you're like, ooh, this is really fascinating. I'm going to go in this direction.
The story, Gwyneth, of me becoming a dietitian is actually, there's a lot of comedy in it. So I went to school for experimental theater, but like, not. So people are like, oh, they're like, that's why you love to speak. I was like, no. I used to do butoh, like covered in like white powder, wearing like a loincloth. Like, no, but it was very avant-garde, like absurd.
My mom used to take me to stuff like that when I was little in New York. It was, listen, weird. It's important. It's weird, but it's cool.
Yeah, like, I thought it was awesome.
She used to take me to the Joyce all the time.
Yes.
I bet I saw you.
So, you know, at some point I realized that actually I wasn't going to be able to like have an apartment or food as an experimental street theater artist. And so I decided, what am I going to do? You know, so I went, I kind of just had a really super basic job. And in my free time, I started training for the Boston Marathon. And my running partner and I, we just love to run, but we were terrible around the nourishment, like really bad around timing our eating or our hydration. And she was literally in and out of the hospital because we were just so bad at it. I seemed to fare better, but she was like in and out of the hospital for overnutrition, undernutrition. And so one day I actually said, I was like, I'm going to just Google like nutrition for runners. And I was like, oh, this is like a thing. Like you can study this. And then like I think on our next long run, I said to her, I was like, listen, Nods, I was like, I should become like a nutritionist. And she was like, that's a great idea. And it's so funny that I kind of fell into that way, because actually by the time I started studying, I realized that like, oh, I love nutrition and I love community and I love the science of it all. And then I just kind of never left and really went headfirst into community nutrition work.
Wow. The interesting thing about reading the book was, you know, I've obviously read a million cookbooks. Like I'll read a cookbook like a novel, and I obviously love to learn. And so the conflation of all this amazing nutritional information and recipes is so cool and pretty new, I feel like. But I loved that you were bringing in all of these old, ancient cultural ingredients and ways of eating in all these cultures around the world, because, you know, this link between the modern Western American diet, you see those graphs. It's like you see diabetes and obesity and heart disease and everything go up and to the right as this highly processed diet was introduced and has to the West and has now taken over the world, unfortunately. And people didn't used to eat and get sick. Is that right?
I mean, it's so incredible, kind of the link between what we put in our mouth. And I always say like the up or down regulation of how our cells behave. Like food is information and we've all heard that. And I completely, like, you know, I talk about it in the book. I remember visiting my grandparents in the Caribbean and like, my grandmother was in the kitchen. She was making something from scratch, like whatever seasoning she made, there were herbs from her backyard. And that's not to say that people weren't getting sick, but the kind of chronic illnesses, they were showing up like much later in adulthood, where like now we're seeing kids 12, 10 with some of these conditions that used to be, I guess, reserved for adults. Of course, there's a link between environment, but there's also definitely, you know, something around how we interact with food, also what's accessible to us, right? That has changed the way that chronic disease or the face of chronic disease, even in the US and around the globe.
Mm. So when you have a patient and they come to you and they have these sort of chronic eating related issues, where do you start?
So I think when I was a young dietitian, meaning like at the beginning of my RD career, I used to give an education and I actually now don't. at the beginning. I ask them to tell me their story, like what brought them to me. Tell me about their nutrition journey, because I've learned that, as I said, like environment, social determinants of health play such a major role in kind of people's perception of food and also what's available to them, what's accessible, what's affordable, and then in turn, kind of what they interact with the majority of the time. So I step back and I learn. Mm-hmm. And then once I begin to learn, there's kind of a back and forth conversation. And I do my best to guide with the, because everybody that I work with has some kind of, you know, chronic condition. I don't have anyone in my practice that's just like, oh, hey, I want to tune up or like level up. So, you know, the idea is to change their clinical outcome. So there is always a goal in mind. And my real kind of hope in my client work and patient work is that we help people step one step closer to improving their labs and their outcomes, but in like a real sustainable way.
Yeah.
Right. So like, if you have high blood pressure, like if you see me or you see one of the dietitians on my team, like our goal is to help you bring your blood pressure back into an expected limit. And if you want to reduce your medication, we want to support that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like super clear. Like we go in and we're like, we will support you in what you want around your health.
Mm-hmm. And will you take us through what are some of the chronic conditions that you feel are best primarily addressed with diet?
Oh, that's such a good question. So the non-communicable conditions, like I think for sure about diabetes, patient self-management, hand in hand with the two. There's so much link between kind of carbohydrate literacy, really understanding the types of carbohydrates that we eat, whether or not they come in liquid or solid form, whether or not we pair them with a meal or we eat them alone, really understanding your individual insulin response. So for sure, diabetes, insulin resistance as well. We work, you know, with people who have high blood pressure, also on the border of having high blood pressure. For sure, high cholesterol, and then cardiovascular disease, but on different levels. We also, I mean, not in my practice, but other dietitians work with renal disease. 100% nutrition plays a huge role there. And also autoimmune conditions. I don't ever say that like it's curative, but it can be 100% supportive.
Wow. Like Hashimoto's and
PCOS. Yeah, absolutely. And also allergies, right? So like when people have food allergies, of course, we're going to work with them, or intolerances. I mean, I feel like the list is getting longer and longer, but that's to say that there are so many chronic conditions that can be both positively and negatively impacted based on what a person's ingesting.
Right. And so for allergies and those chronic conditions of autoimmune, are those all related to inflammation in the gut?
So I'm all because I have this like sciencey background, I'm always really careful to say that, like, I can't say that this is the root cause.
Right, of course.
But I can say that on kind of a really broad kind of spectrum, we know that inflammation is at the root of all chronic conditions. Where the inflammation kind of originates, sometimes we don't know, and we don't always know the mechanisms for why things get turned on and other things don't. But to your point, we know that the gut has a lot to do with immunity. And when I say immunity, like, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that, like, you know, the gut is going to stop you from. However, when you are able to feed and nourish your gut, it is able to express optimal health. And so people are like, what does that mean? It means like when we give the gut fiber and when we feed polyphenols and when we're mindful about the added sugars, the added salts, the synthetic and the saturated fats and the lab-made fats, we allow the health of the gut and the diversity of the microbiome to flourish, right? We want diverse gut bacteria. When it's like a monoculture down there, it's no good for us.
Yeah. So what's happening to the gut when we eat something, for example, that's highly, highly processed?
So I always like to go back, and this is something that with my colleagues, we spend so much time talking about, like, what is a processed food and what does it mean for something to be like ultra processed versus, you know, minimally processed. And in my practice, because I work with chronic conditions, we're very much focused on the quantity of the added sugars, salts, and fats. And here's the thing that's so interesting is that think about some of those like vegan meat substitutes. You know, people enjoy them for whatever reason. And they can, you know what I mean? They can be very processed, right? That at the same time, right? I have patients who are like, you know, from time to time, I want to try it. And so I say, all right, we want this also in the context of food that is minimally processed or in its whole form. I don't want to go too far off topic, but I often say this. We don't want people eating only salad every single day because then you're missing out on nutrients. And we don't want people only eating, you know, something like a frozen pizza every single day because then you're missing out on nutrients. And so I'm super careful because I also work with people who need convenience foods, right? But what I will say that when the center of our pattern of eating is foods that have that abundance of those added sugars, salts, and the fats, but the synthetic and the lab made, metabolic dysfunction is, I would say, almost always kind of a point that shows up. And it's always hard for me to say that because I'm so acutely aware that, like, I don't want to shame anyone. You know what I mean? And I also know that access is a major problem for, like, historically marginalized communities. But I also know that those are the very foods that are in abundance in those communities. And then we see these super high rates of all of those conditions. And it's like, you know, it's a challenge even to talk about it. Like, how do you come to terms with the fact that, like, yeah, if that's what is accessible and if that's the majority of what you're consuming, then you're at increased risk for not being well. What? And it's not your fault, you know? Yeah. So.
And it's such a one awful part of, and of which there are many, of capitalism, which is, you know, convincing people throughout the world in different communities that, you know, this is easy and cheap and delicious. And therefore, you know, your health can be compromised long-term. I mean, to your point, and this is so beautifully descripted in the book, like you talk about going to Trinidad to where your grandparents were, and it doesn't sound like it was, you know, a super affluent community, but the food was local. It was fresh. It was seasonal. It was there. It was amazing to read. I felt like you were transporting me back to your childhood, and I was smelling all the spices and, you know, the curries and everything that was going on your grandmother's stove.
It was amazing. I mean, so here's the thing that's really, like, funny. Like, when I think back to my grandparents and I think back to my grandmother, you know, this was a time kind of in the world where, like, women didn't work. You know what I mean? So, like,
yeah,
the man went out and worked, and my grandfather worked really close with, like, parliament in Trinidad and Tobago. So he was really involved in labor kind of laws and issues. And I think that's where I got, like, my social justice from. Like, it was, like, early on. But, like, my grandmother cooked for her family, and then she would go out and she would volunteer, and she would cook for, I mean, it was terrible the way that they referred to unhoused people back then. But so she would go and she would, like, volunteer her time. And what was so interesting, as you were saying that, it reminded me, like, you're right. They made food. So yeah. Imagine going in, you know, like the 70s to a place where people are, you know, receiving meals. It was fresh. It was all of these women who volunteered their time and would go down to the local church and cook. And they went multiple times per week, and they would just feed the unhoused population, you know, and then they would go back home and then they would feed their families. But it was really, food was based around someone being in the kitchen and someone actually working with ingredients in their whole and minimally processed form. And it was delicious. And also it was full of respect. right?
Yeah. And so, like, if we're talking about quality of food, you know, you just said minimally processed whole food, is it an inherently privileged thing to expect to have whole foods and whole nutrition? Like, how systemically and societally can we change that?
I mean, that is like the $1 million question. I think it's an amazing question, Gwyneth. Like, to be honest, like it's something I think about all the time, because you're right. At least in developed nations, it has come to be a sign of privilege to be able to make choices around your food. When in fact, it's so funny, my dad said to me, I was visiting him in Haiti and he built a community center there, an education center. And he said, you know, our food has always been organic here. And this is like, you know, it doesn't matter how people feel about organic food, but he's like, our food has always been organic. We've always grown it with soil health in mind. Right. You know what I mean? Taking care of the animals, taking care of the land, and like wanting to have a product that is nourishing.
Right.
And that was, you know, just across the board. And so when I think about that question, has it become a privilege? Yes. And is it totally intertwined with like food politics? 100%. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're at the point where when we have these conversations, because it is a privilege, so many people get left out of the conversation.
Yeah.
Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
In the agribusiness that exists, you know, in America, I think, you know, where we, our system is so focused on profits, like that impacts us, right? I mean, is there a difference between, I would love to ask you a little bit about the quality of the meat. Cause you know, there's always a, should we be vegetarian? Should we not? And recently I've really come to understand that there's incredible environmental benefit to raising animals for food regeneratively, not only for the environment, but for from a nutritional standpoint. And I would just love to ask you about that.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely, when I work with my patients and when we're able to make choices around where food is coming from, I say where it comes from and how it was farmed absolutely matters. Absolutely has an impact on the end product. And it's so, I mean, like I pause so much when I think and talk about food because it's complicated, right? It's hard for me to say, yeah, I absolutely want people having beef and lamb from really high quality sources that are thinking about, you know, well, what's happening? What's the methane production, right? Like, what are we doing to this cow? What are we feeding the cow? It's so interesting. I heard a talk this weekend talking about actually beef and lamb from Australia and how they're really involved in reducing the methane that's, you know, being produced. And I thought, well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Right. Imagine if that was something every piece of beef and lamb that everyone consumed, for all the meat eaters, because people who eat meat, there are quite a few of them, right? But imagine if it came from a regenerative farm.
Yeah.
Imagine if that was the standard. We'd be talking about reducing CO2 emissions like in a major way. Mm-hmm. And that's really about the future. And so I feel like sometimes that's why I pause, because I know that when we're talking about sustainability and when we're talking about food, like we need a combination of top down, bottom up, and we need industries to really shift their priority from like profits to thinking about people and future. And we're absolutely better off, like 100%, when we pay attention to where our animal proteins are coming from, you know, how they're raised, what they're being fed, the health of the soil, and so on.
And can I just double click a little bit on that from the science perspective? Like, what happens or doesn't happen that makes certain kinds of meat raised certain kinds of way better for us?
So this is an area that like I am, I would say, you know, researching, and that there's tons more research to be done, but this is my understanding. Yeah. That when meat or like ruminants are, you know, like beef are grass fed and grass finished, it actually changes the nutrient profile of the meat and it tends to be leaner. So when we're thinking about people who have cardiovascular conditions or metabolic conditions, at least in my practice, we definitely like grass fed, grass finished for those patients, just because they tend to have like a low, the protein itself tends to have a lower lipid profile. It's not nearly as marbled. And so you have to modify the cooking. A lot of people say like, they're like, oh, this grass-fed stuff, it's, you know, it's robust. And I'm like, yeah, we're not accustomed to it. We're really accustomed to, you know, kind of corn finished.
That's what the Instant Pot is for, right? The pressure cooker.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yep. So, but that's kind of, you know, one of the differences that we see. I also recently learned too, that when we feed these ruminant animals things like lentils, it also helps to sequester some of the, you know, methane that they produce, which I thought was really cool. So it's like, not only do we benefit from having beans in our pattern of eating, so do they.
Amazing. So as part of my trying to lower inflammation, I have been doing like an intermittent fasting window, not a huge one, but you know, it's like, I try not to eat anything until lunch. What is a healthy way for those of us who intermittent fast because we have something going on, or just some people just like it or they're whatever. What is the best way to break that? Because if, sometimes you're so hungry, you're just like reaching for whatever. And then I'm like, I'm sure I'm not helping the longer term picture here.
I love that question. And so I say two things. We would all intermittently fast if we would wake up in the morning, have our first meal, you know, sometime after waking, and then dinner would be our culminating meal. We would right. all be engaging in intermittent fasting.
Right.
And I often tell my patients that. And the reason I say that, and it's not extraordinary, but there are many of us that have dinner and then continue to eat into the night.
Yeah.
So I just leave that there. No judgments, but just a statement.
Right, right.
The number one that I say for people who want to intermittent fast is that planning ahead really allows you to go in and out of the fast, both mindfully and intentionally, around food. So if the focus is intermittent fasting because you're trying to impact your blood sugars and whatever the window, right? But let's just say there's a period of time where there's no food coming in. Then that first meal, in theory, I would love to see a great source of fiber and I would love to see some type of protein. And that can be totally different and we can modify it for people who eat animals, for people who don't eat animals.
But what would really be an example of a couple, like a vegetarian version and a, you know,
right. So like we could see something like beans and maybe a sweet potato and some type of green. And I would have like ginger, garlic, onion. I tend to love things like turmeric, cumin, black pepper, you know, but so like really well seasoned. But if we want to go another direction, you could go like, you know, tarragon and sage. And that's amazing, you know, with lemon and olive oil. But like, you know, play with the type of bean. So it could be a lentil with carrots, but it could be a black bean, you know what I mean? But that's what I would love to see, some type of bean, some type of starch, sweet potato, potato, cassava, plantain, and then some like mixture of dark greens. Could be cabbage, bok choy, Chinese broccoli, you know what I mean? You name it, like pea shoots, whatever. For the meat eater, I like to see any kind of animal protein that they like. I am partial to seafood. just that's like my Maya's personal preference. And I love fatty fish. I also love tiny fish. I don't know if that's because like I grew up with Caribbean grandparents, but like I'm totally fine with all the small fish.
Low in mercury, those fish, right?
So good. So good. And like they are like packed with protein, omega-3s. You're getting like all the calcium and the D. Like it's just they're like delicious little packages.
I'm an anchovy girl. I love anchovies.
So good, right? So good.
I'm in the minority, but that's okay. I'm sticking with it.
I was just in Iceland recently and I was like, oh, this herring is delicious. And everyone was like, what? I was like, I love it. But so yeah, I would love to see some type of animal protein of your choice. And I do like starch. And I think it can be like really like any type of starch or grain that you like. I like black rice a lot. It's really quick cooking, but it's great polyphenol content because it's black. So it's like just super nutrient rich and also a good source of fiber. And of course, you know, some type of non-starchy vegetable. I love the cruciferous vegetables and I'm a big mixer of like Brussels sprouts, kale, collard, Swiss chard, like in a dish together.
Mm. And it's the season right now.
It is. Indeed. Indeed.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Acer bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Acer is the bag to carry for your 9 to 5 and the 5 to 9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Acer collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
I would like to ask you this, and it's a, you know, maybe like a little bit of a topic, but, you know, I find that in our culture, there's a lot of talk around, you know, like health and wellness and intermittent fasting and, you know, wearing a glucose monitor. There's a lot of observation and measurement around what we're eating, when we're eating it, you know, and I think there are things that people have agreed on, right? Like if possible, it's good to eat dinner and then not eat till breakfast, right? To let, that's an intermittent fast, to let the body rest from digesting and, you know, expel some toxins, right? I sometimes worry that like we're a culture that's predisposed to disordered eating, the barrage of images that we see and what we're supposed to look like and blah, blah, blah. We all know, you know, culturally that whole story. But now there's this like wellness eating piece that's coming into the picture. And so I'm like, what is healthy and what is disordered? I'm trying to sort of understand while like even for myself, just bringing more grace into, you know, and I think mine was catalyzed by this real gut health issue that I'm dealing with. But then I'm like, is this okay? Like, you know, what is wellness and where does it get tipped into like something that's not, you know, that's more disordered? And do you see this a lot?
Yeah. I mean, this is a topic. This is it's like for everyone listening, I'm like, take a deep breath.
I know.
You know what I mean? It's a topic. It is a heavy, heavy, heavy topic because the line has been blurred.
Right.
And so much of the culture of dieting has been explained through the lens of this is what everyone should do. And if you're not engaged in this, well, then there's a morality around it. You're not good, right? Because it's binary. And you're
like
not
everything else.
100%. You know, and like if you get sick, it's your fault because you didn't follow this like, you know, pathway. And it's exclusive. And it like goes back to your question of, is eating this way a privilege? And this was something that I was talking through with a colleague of mine. We were talking about, and this is, I just learned this word, mixed amylization. So it's the process of pounding corn, but then adding either ash or lime, and as has been done in like indigenous Amerindian cultures. And it's like an incredible way to consume corn. That's stone ground corn with either like ash or lime. And it's like super nutrient rich. That is now a fancy thing, right? And then, but it's at the same time demonized. So to your question of like, you know, when do we enter into this like restrictive, don't eat this, don't eat that, follow, you know, kind of this prescriptive diet pattern. I think it's like one big ball of yarn that's completely intertwined. And it really goes back to what you said, and it's with profits at the top.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, at least in my experience or kind of how I think about it, you know, go travel through parts of Europe. Food is not nearly that complicated. You right. can walk into places and you can get strawberries for €2 in the summertime. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yeah. Right. Yeah. And I think that in the complexity of it, because the culture of dieting is big business, that it's also been confounded with if you engage in X diet, you are guaranteed to be healthy. And so we have a sick nation that's hungry for being better. Like everybody wants to, you know what I mean? Live a fulfilled, robust life. Mm. It's like a crime of opportunity.
Yeah. So interesting. I noticed too that when, you know, you go to other cultures, that was so beautiful what you said about in other cultures, food just being more simple. And I was really struck by that. And when I think about how much morality we place on it, how much identity, how much it's so complicated for us as a nation. And now that we're sort of hyper fine tuning this wellness thing, it's just struck me recently. Like, are we going about this in the right way? Like, are we giving ourselves grace through these processes? And, you know, instead of kind of being hyper perfectionist about what we should be eating and what we're cutting out and what we're allowed to have. And I mean, I'm guilty of that myself.
I don't think there's grace. You know what I mean? There's so many of my patients that feel guilt. They feel shame, you know, DMI, I wish it would be thrown away.
Yeah.
I wish it would be tossed out. I have patients that before they even walk into a doctor's office, the doctor's on them about, you know, their BMI, and they may not be there to talk about, you know, weight loss. They're usually, in my case, there for their blood pressure or their blood sugars, right? Yeah. And I think there's no grace. I think also like food and imagery are totally linked into youth and able-bodied people. Mm. So, you know, we see these images and we equate health with young, quote unquote, fit, quote unquote, slender people who have thinness, you know, and then also too, it breaks down on racial lines. And so I think there is no grace. Like we don't see images of older people, you know, enjoying life. And when I say older, like, I mean, we don't see women in their fourth and fifth decade of life being portrayed as the bastion of wellness. We see pictures of people who are 20 and 30 eating salad, and that's healthy. That's, right. You know what I mean? That's what we all think of when we think healthy.
Right. Right. And isn't it true as well that for some people, like, for example, I unfortunately am not supposed to eat a lot of legumes right now because of my gut situation. But for a lot of people, legumes are incredibly healthy. You know, some people are more prone to digest certain things better than others. And it's not a copy and paste, is it?
Not at all. I love that you said that, right? So I've worked with people who have, you know, SIBO or who are dealing with, you know, IBS or IBD. We have to be really mindful of those cruciferous vegetables, especially yeah. in large quantities. And also the legumes, like that's a digestive nightmare for them. When the recommendations are eat, you know, a serving and a half of beans per day, one size absolutely does not fit all. And that goes back to where's the grace? right? We're super copy-paste.
Yeah. On page 172.
Okay, I'm going to 172.
Of Eating From Our Roots.
Okay, I'm with you.
You have, this is what I want to make first. I'm going to make it this weekend. Salted cod from Trinidad and Tobago. Salted cod is a popular breakfast dish in Trinidad and Tobago that is often made with vegetables, fresh herbs, and spices. It may be served with a bake, a quick bread, or boiled dumplings and a dollop of pepper sauce. I like to pair mine with bake, as well as avocado and cucumber. Full of flavor and easy to prepare, this savory breakfast is perfect for a large crowd. This is breakfast!
Yes.
And yes. I spent all weekend making breakfast for my husband and looking for unusual things. But before we talk about the recipe, this is one of my favorite parts of the book because it's in every recipe. Ingredient highlight. Thyme, a fragrant herb, holds its own when it comes to its nutrient profile. When consumed in large quantities, it is an antioxidant-rich source of vitamin C and a good source of fat-soluble vitamin A, both of which support immune function. I didn't know that about thyme.
Yes. Isn't that amazing?
I love this. Okay. So first of all, thank you for these notes because I've learned about the nutritional value of all the herbs that I use all the time. So this breakfast, will you tell me what is a bake and what do I serve on the side of this gorgeous looking thing?
So a bake first, and it depends on what island you're from. And also I have to say in London, England, they also have bake there in the form of, I believe they refer to them as Johnny cakes. But a bake is like a quick bread. And my family, when we go up to the countryside to visit all the aunties, there would always be bake just waiting. And they would do coconut bake. And so it was like fresh coconut. I mean, I'm telling you, they would take the coconut, crack the coconut, strain the water, reserve it, grate the coconut. The amount of love that would go into this dish, and it was just perfect. Mm. And they would bake it, and then, you know, you could enjoy it with this salted cod. I put avocado on the side, mainly because I think of my dad, who's Haitian, not Trinidadian, but would eat avocado with everything. Everything, including pasta.
Oh my God.
I know. We would always make fun of him. We'd be like, really? And he was like, yeah, it's delicious. And it's like, okay. But I have avocado and cucumber just because I think that those flavors lend themselves to what's going on in the dish. And yeah, so you could have it with bake. You could have it alone if you're feeling very adventurous and you're up for boiling cassava. You could boil cassava and enjoy that on the side for like a really nice savory breakfast.
Oh, you've completely opened my world here.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes a new movie called Challengers, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya plays Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who transforms her husband, Art, into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt her husband out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event, close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when Art finds himself standing across a net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Tensions run high as past and present collide. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26. Get tickets now at challengersmovie.com.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation. The other thing that I want to make first or second, I haven't decided, is the egga?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So that's kind of like for some people who are thinking about it, it's like it's an Egyptian style omelet. And I think the flavors are just incredible. I think they're out of this world. And that one actually was contributed by Chef Gerald. And I remember when that recipe came in and we were testing it, I was just like, oh my goodness, this is good.
I'm so excited. So how did you find these? Because you worked with 7 chefs, right, to help bring these recipes to life. Tell me a little bit about that process.
Yeah. So I knew that all the recipes had to be tested by chefs. And I should go back and say, I knew that because I'm a dietitian, I've been trained to like remove flavor. Like we take salt away, we take sugar away, we take fat away. Like that's our first thing that we do when we look at a recipe is we start cutting those things. And I said, I absolutely have to work with someone who's going to impart those flavors in mindful and intentional ways. Because I want a book that actually people want to make the dishes, right? Like there are plenty of quote unquote diet books out there, but how often do we return to those recipes unless we're on the diet? And what I wanted was a book that just had super nourishing food that could be made anytime. And of course you can modify as you need. So I reached out to 2 people. Number one, my dear, dear friend, Chef Sylvia Barbon, who is like, I have now referred to her as my chef sister. So she's like this incredible, she's just got such a love of flavor and she's super talented. So I reached out to her and said, you know, chef, I want to start interviewing other chefs and I'm looking for people who either are not American, right? Or are like first generation from somewhere else. Or people who've done extensive travel in these areas. And so, I mean, we had like from her, like a list of 20 people. And then I reached out to Chef Bill Telpan, who is the culinary director at the Met, and said the same thing. And he gave me a list of people who I talked to, including like the pastry chef at Aquavit, you know, Chef JJ from Field Trip, you know, so like I was talking to people and they all gave me their time. Like everyone gave me 30 minutes and I was just asking questions about flavors and kitchens because I'm a dietitian. I don't know anything about this stuff. And then I said, you know what? I'm going to reach out to these people and ask them to actually contribute. So I picked 7 of them and said, will you contribute recipes from these areas? Some of them were Chef Sylvia's friends. Some of them were the people that Chef Bill Telpan had recommended. And then we started to get these amazing submissions. I did modify them, full disclosure, you know, so there were ingredients that sometimes I added in or some things that I took out. I did make modifications to every single recipe.
And you cook at home? You cook?
Yeah. I cook every single day. Except for tonight.
Where are you going tonight?
Oh my goodness. I wish I was going out. I think that something's being brought in. Yeah. Okay.
No shame, no judgment.
No shame, no judgment. I know. So, but yeah, I say we cook the majority of the time. And so, you know, as Chef Sylvia and I were working together, she was the main chef and tester in the kitchen. So we were in the kitchen for probably a month together, if I remember correctly. And this was in the shutdown portion of the pandemic. And her girlfriend was the only other person besides my husband that was in the kitchen with us because we were like, we potted. And then all the testers would show up at the doorstep with Tupperware and we would hand out bags of food. Amazing. Or I would walk around and, you know, because some people lived close and deliver them bags of food. And then we would get all this feedback, right? Like, we thought this was great. What was this? I didn't know that. What are you doing here? You know, I felt like it needed more salinity or this. And so some recipes I did like 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
Some recipes we did twice, but we were just in there working with the food, working with the flavors.
That's the way to do it. That's the way to do it. Right. That really is. That makes me even more excited to cook from the book because, you know, I've done a couple of books and I was because I felt like I have no business writing a book. I just want to write a cookbook about my dad and my love of food and the amount of testing and making sure and feedback so that other cooks, you know, could rely on the recipes. I'm so excited too. What do you think I should cook? What's the signature thing?
So
I have my breakfast that I'm starting with. Okay. What about dinner?
So other than legumes, is there anything that you're not eating at the moment?
I mean, like when I look at the EGGA, for example, like I'll use forager sour cream instead of regular. Like I'm pretty good with substitutions, but just like the grains and legumes right now, I'm not having.
Okay. So I think there's the salad that has lobster tail. Yeah, that is really delicious. The grilled artichoke was—
Oh, I saw that. With the herby dressing thing, that looked amazing.
And you can swap that and you could just do like the plain foragers. I wonder if that peely nut— do you remember that peely nut yogurt that was around for a little while? I don't know if it was Lava, but they had like an interesting— it has an interesting flavor. That could be a nice substitution.
Okay, nice. Thank you.
Yeah. I would do that. Or, the peri-peri chicken.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. You could do that. Or actually, I have no favorites, but I love seafood. You could do the octopus.
I can't. I can't do it. They're too smart. They're too sweet.
I know. That's a controversial dish.
I have to give it up.
Yeah, it's a controversial dish. This is like, okay. You know what you could put in its place? Do you do well with other shellfish, or are you okay
anything
with it?
Anything.
Yeah. Because you could put like crawfish in there instead.
Ooh, okay. Crawfish, langoustines, like that.
Yes. Definitely langoustine. Because that langoustine right now is a bit easier to find.
And I'm in California. So we have those Santa Barbara prawns that come straight out of the ocean. They're so good. Those langoustines.
That sounds delicious.
Okay. Maybe I'll do this as a lightning round.
Okay.
But the first one might need a little bit more explanation.
Okay.
Canola oil, seed oil, canola oil, yes or no?
Oh, that's such a hard question. And it's interesting because I learned from my chef friends that it's a yes.
Canola is a yes.
Yeah, there's so many. Here's the thing, and I'm going to put it in context. I believe you have to vary your oils. Like,
what do you saute with?
Actually, avocado oil.
Uh-huh, me too. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. And you see that it shows up in the book quite a bit, and it's because it can tolerate high heat.
It doesn't get rancid.
Rancid. Right. Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. I feel very connected to you on this. Okay. Alt milks or cow milk?
Oh, that's so hard. Okay. As the person who has lactose-free 2% milk, like an ounce in their coffee every single morning, I'm going to say for Maya, cow milk, it's organic value. I mean, 2% lactose-free milk. For the people out there, make the choice that works for your body and also your values.
I love that answer. And if you're going to go with an alt milk, or from a nutritionist dietitian standpoint, are there ones that are better, or should we make them at home? Oat milk spikes my glucose, does it really depend on the person? Or
it depends on the person. If you're able to make it at home, there's so many cool machines that make them in like just a fraction, like no time at all. And the only reason that I say that also is because with inflation, like things are just unbelievably expensive. And if you're using an alt milk, it's never bad if you can tolerate nuts or seeds to actually have that base ingredient, and then you can use it like across multiple cooking applications.
Okay. Nightshades, yes or no?
So again, needs a caveat. I say yes, but then I have patients who have not been able to tolerate them. Okay. Right. And so again, it's totally individual. I have some patients who just like could not tolerate them, but if you can, go for it.
Okay. Dairy, like cheese and, you know, sour cream and stuff like that.
I love fermented dairy. For people who can tolerate it. I love skyr. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I love fermented dairy. I love sheep. I love goat milk, all of those, and the cheeses. If you can tolerate it, I think that's fantastic.
Okay. White rice or brown rice? Or black?
Ooh, both. Red, black, white, brown, wild, although it's not rice, but all of the above.
Wow. Okay. Coffee, is that okay?
So again, there's the caveat for people who are not caffeine sensitive. Like I have patients who, you know, have generalized anxiety disorder. Coffee sometimes works for them. If they're in an agitated state, that's a hard no. I also think time of day matters, especially for people who are thinking about getting to sleep. For people who experience elevated blood pressure and are sensitive, again, you just have to be mindful. I have some people that do really well with like a cup in the morning. That's it.
But some people say it's a superfood and packed with antioxidants. And I just read this article in the New York Times that it's so great for you.
So it's so funny because it is actually like, I think it's the number one source of where people living in the US get their antioxidants.
I've read that.
It's coffee, right? I mean, I think the challenge is that we're so like some is good, more is better. And then you have people chugging coffee all day and then displacing their desire for like actual food, you know? And so that's why I'm like, just be aware of how your body feels on coffee. And also like, you know, are you doing well on like 24 ounce cups of coffee? Maybe you are, maybe you're not.
Mm-hmm. Alcohol.
This is a unequivocal. I hung out with the Distilled Spirits Council recently. And man, let me tell you, when you learn what a standard drink is, most of us, if you imbibe, are not having a standard drink. I would say do it responsibly and be super mindful and intentional and absolutely in moderation. Like, absolutely.
Do you drink?
I do drink. I do not drink Monday through Friday, and I don't save up for Saturday and Sunday and have 10 drinks.
Right.
But then I do then drink. And do I have fun with my friends from time to time? 100%. Do I feel it the next day? Yes. Like I can't get down. Like, I can't do it.
I feel you. Okay. Here's my last question. Is there one food or, I don't know, drink, or is there something that when you eat it, you feel like, it immediately kind of lifts you up?
So yes, 100%. I love lobsters. I love oysters. I think it's because I'm from Massachusetts. You know what I mean? I was born there. And then with like the Caribbean roots, like I'm just like ocean through and through.
Oh, that's so great. Maya, what a pleasure. What an honor to publish this phenomenal book. I am so excited about it.
I am beyond thrilled that you love the book, for like entering into this conversation. You know what I mean? Like having these sticky, messy talks that are not neatly tied up into a bow.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely. That's what we do here at Goop.
Yeah, you do. I'm so glad to be in conversation with you.
Thank you so much for listening to my chat with Maya Feller. For more from Maya, pick up a copy of her new book, Eating from Our Roots, which is out today. I cannot recommend it enough. Thanks for tuning in. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts.